by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Welcome to The Manic Gardener, where each week we look at something relating to organic gardening. This week, we'll be talking with a couple of people who have set out to harness one of the Earth's most powerful and dangerous forces, the volcano, in the service of, you guessed it, organic gardening. At the end of the show, of course, there will be your gardening tip. Stay tuned for that. One of the things I love about organic gardening, along with the clean smell of earth and the tightly curled, clean pink worms I find when I dig in it, and the crisp sound of a knife slicing into a new dug potato, and the taste of fresh chard, so different from that tired stuff you find at the grocery store. As I say, one of the things that's right up there with all of that is the way that organic gardening so frequently involves a whole community. Practically every time you turn around or pick up a newspaper or a magazine, you'll hear or read about another program that uses organic gardening to educate, to rehabilitate, and to connect people with each other as well as with the earth. More and more schools have gardens, as do mental health centers and prisons. Community gardens are popping up across North America, as are organizations that help people establish gardens in their own yards. Now, not all of these programs, not all of these gardens are organic, but many are. Most, quite clearly and explicitly, set out to provide an alternative to the homogenized fresh food section of the supermarket, which offers the same New Zealand apples from New Mexico to Minnesota and from Montreal to Vancouver. I find this a remarkable and heartening trend. So from time to time on The Manic Gardener, I want to look at one of these programs in some detail. In the first of this occasional series, I want to share with you one of the most remarkable projects I've encountered, a small town in southwest Montana that has come together to build a geothermally heated community greenhouse. Ennis, population about 1,000, lies in the upper Madison River Valley, and you can see between 3 and 5 mountain ranges from it, depending on how you count. It's only about 50 miles from the northeast corner of Yellowstone Park, home of Old Faithful and thousands of other geysers, mud pots, hot springs, and fumaroles, not to mention the supervolcano itself. The Yellowstone caldera, whose eruptions put Mount St. Helens to shame. My point here is that this corner of Montana, where I live, by the way, has a lot going on geology-wise. So it's a reasonable place to build a greenhouse that will be heated through hot spring waters. That's what Madison Farm to Fork has decided to do, and we will be talking with a couple of people intimately involved in that project. The first one is Cindy Owings, secretary and founding member of Madison Farm to Fork. I went to Ennis to ask Cindy about the greenhouse, but almost as soon as we began to talk, we were talking not about the greenhouse itself, but why she and others felt it was necessary. And this was closely linked to things that she felt had been lost, parts of what had long been basic to life in Montana that were now becoming rare. Most obviously, what she felt was being lost was a connection to the land, an ability to grow one's own food in a simple and natural way, what we now call organically. But I feel that something even more fundamental than organic gardening was at stake here. Listen to what Cindy said about working in the schools.
A lot of the kids that we worked with are, you know, in the very beginning, they had never, ever touched soil.
But that was much later in the conversation. When we started to talk, Cindy referred to what she called the food shed. And she didn't mean a physical structure. It was something closer to a watershed, she said. And she described it like this.
A food shed concentrates on fostering food in a region that's close by. Mm-hmm. So you're saving on gas miles, getting food
transportation
here. Exactly.
Yep.
And you're also nurturing the idea that we can all grow our own food.
Right.
Right here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And we can be self-sufficient.
Right.
Again. Based on, you know, that the idea that we can grow our own food.
So why do you say again?
Because 50 years ago, Montana itself was totally self-sufficient in its food. It no longer is.
Right, right.
And I don't know what the exact numbers are on the amount of food that we import, but we all know that isn't true anymore.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
so
most of us are using supermarkets and
exactly
stuff comes from everywhere.
Yeah, and you can get strawberries and blueberries year round.
Right.
So, and we all know that isn't right.
It's certainly not local. It is strange and strangely disturbing to realize that the conditions that Cindy is describing pertain to Montana, a state with fewer than 1 million inhabitants, in which exactly one city, Billings, has a population of over 100,000, and only three have populations of over 50,000. And yet, we are here in this very, very rural state, disconnected from the land and unacquainted with where our food comes from.
Madison County is, I think it's the largest county in Montana. It's as big as Delaware and Maryland together.
The county?
Right, the county.
Wow.
On its own. And it mainly is made up of cattle ranches.
Uh-huh.
And so who, by the way, most send their cattle out of state. So what does that
mean? To be slaughtered, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we never see that great beef.
Right.
You know, it goes into this big pot of beef. And then so now Montana is importing its own beef.
Okay.
And most of the beef that we import is not ours.
Right.
So we have a grocery store here that sells very expensive imported food mm-hmm. that tastes awful.
Okay? Lovely.
And so
you make it sound so good, Cindy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you want an alternative to that?
Yeah. Exactly. We have a grocery store here that sells very expensive imported food mm-hmm. that tastes awful.
Okay? Lovely.
And so
you make it sound so good, Cindy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you want an alternative to that?
Yeah, exactly.
How did you start to go about fulfilling this mission of providing fresh food throughout that food shed?
Well, we knew that we would eventually end up having to Madison Farm to Fork would end up having to grow its own food,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't jump right into it.
A certain amount of market research was required, but there were other things at stake as well.
And so we also wanted an opportunity to be able to educate young people and educate our community. And beyond that, we wanted to involve our community in this whole process. So the first thing that we did is start a farmers market.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now in our third year. And we discovered one big problem with the farmers market is that
What's
we didn't
that?
Have enough food at the farmers market. We didn't have enough fresh food. And so then
you had more people, more customers than could be satisfied?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's a nice problem.
It is mm-hmm. a nice problem.
Oh.
Then the council tackled the idea of why don't we start our own greenhouse?
Mm-hmm.
We knew that there was a hot springs 1 mile north of Ennis,
uh-huh.
and it's undeveloped.
Uh-huh.
And the hot springs owner happens to be a very philanthropic community member.
Uh-huh.
He
That's convenient.
Yeah, he got really excited about our idea, which was to have a greenhouse that's geothermally heated.
It was not, in fact, the first time that this hot spring had been used to heat a greenhouse, but the first time didn't go so well.
His greenhouse or his hot springs had been used for an enterprise maybe 10 years ago to grow roses in a greenhouse
north
of Venice.
And had that actually been built?
Yeah, it's still there.
And it went out of production.
The reason it went out is because they pumped the hot water itself through tubes across the highway and into the greenhouse. And what happened is the tubes that they pumped it through became corroded with the toxicity from the hot springs.
Because the hot spring, of course, contains a whole lot of minerals and apparently.
Exactly.
So you started off knowing that that would not work.
Right.
The difference this time was a new technology, heat exchangers. These are not actually so new or so rare. They are any of a number of different mechanisms that are used to allow heat to be moved between one fluid and another without those two fluids touching each other. They're used in your refrigerator, they're used in your car, in a car radiator. Hot fluid circulates through pipes. That's the first fluid. And air, the second fluid, then flows over the pipes, dissipating the heat. The ones used in the greenhouse, however, are of a very different sort. Having figured out how to heat the greenhouse, they now had to find one, which they did on Craigslist. Of course, it wasn't in Ennis. That would have been too easy. It was in Helena, not right next door, and so a group of volunteers brought it back in winter, which was no mean feat.
So it's aluminum hoops that are covered with two layers of plastic.
Right. Yeah. How about how much space is between them?
About 4 or 5 inches.
Right. And a fan blows air between them.
Right.
And your plan is to have it blowing warm air.
No, our plan is to warm the soil.
Oh, your plan is to warm the soil.
Yeah.
Okay.
The soil, the floor of the greenhouse and the floor of the outside garden.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, we were going to have a greenhouse that was on rollers, which this one is, and roll it
into place.
Have it grow for 2 or 3 years where it is right now,
right,
and then move it forward to grow into a commensurate space.
So that you would be rotating crops, essentially? You would be able to let the original soil rest? Was that the reason?
Right.
Okay.
So that we could get rid of any pests or any weirdness that's happening in there.
But you've changed that plan.
Yeah, based on the fact that we can't keep the greenhouse in place when it's on rollers because of the wind here.
Oh.
And the wind in Madison County is considerable. It can get up to, 50, 60 miles an hour.
So it had to be a permanent structure.
Yeah.
All right.
So now it is.
And all right.
So what we did is then we put the tubes that take the hot water, they are 4 feet underground.
Uh-huh.
They're in the greenhouse and they're also in front of the greenhouse in the outside garden.
Right.
So then we put raised beds because you have to be about 6 inches, or what do I think? Not 6 inches. Your roots, the roots of plants cannot come get too close to the heated tubes.
Right, right.
So
you need a couple feet of soil.
At least a couple feet, maybe 3 or 4 feet.
Right.
So the tubes are 4 feet under, and then we made 1 foot high raised beds.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's
lovely. So that's what we've been growing in.
Right. Where did you get your soil?
We made the soil.
Out of what?
We made it out of composted horse manure from a ranch.
Is it organic?
It is.
Okay.
I mean, it's not
That's
organic.
That's a very important point for organic gardeners. They need to be careful about where they get their manures from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we got topsoil from an excavator who had done a project near the Madison River.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like river bottom soil.
Oh, nice.
And so we mix the horse manure with the topsoil because uh-huh. topsoil doesn't have anything in it really to speak of,
right.
any nutrients.
This added nutrients and mm-hmm. organic matter to feed worms and
right.
microorganisms. Nice.
Yeah.
Did you bother with any other actual fertilizers?
You mean amendments?
Yeah.
Yeah, we put specific amendments, like we put green sand in with the tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
We put
So depending on the particular crop.
Right.
Nice.
Right. And we made compost teas.
Did you?
To add to other crops. Yeah.
All right. So you had particular amendments with particular crops.
Mm-hmm.
And, can I go back for one moment to the horse manure? Can you say something about why it is that organic farmers need to be, or gardeners need to be careful about horse manure? What can go wrong with manures?
One of the things that you do need to be careful with is what the animals are fed. If they're fed hay that's been sprayed with pesticides,
uh-huh.
then it comes through.
Doesn't and it break down?
No,
okay.
It doesn't. And so it remains in the manure that comes out of the horse.
Right.
So you can't, that's why a lot of composts now in the state of Montana have been contaminated, because there's drifting of pesticide spraying of
yeah.
weeds.
Yeah.
And so you have to really be careful about your compost.
Right. So after you got all of this set up, what was your first year when you actually got a chance to grow something?
2011.
This year?
Yeah, starting uh-huh. in March.
Okay. And what did you plant?
We planted carrots and lettuce and spinach.
And
several kinds of lettuce, mixed greens.
And did you have heat running through these?
No.
No heat?
No. We've done, all of our growing in 2011 has been based on traditional greenhouse growing methods based on the sun.
Right.
Basically.
So passive heating.
Right.
Right.
Right. And
right.
so,
because you can't usually plant, I mean, those are your early crops, but you can't
yeah.
plant those in Montana in March, generally
yeah.
speaking.
Right.
Were you
right.
planting these only in the greenhouse then?
Yeah.
And that's what,
uh-huh.
a couple of months earlier than you'd usually
yeah.
be able to plant?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it gave you a real jump on the season.
Yeah, it did.
Uh-huh.
And so we started with the cold weather crops, and we started with crops in our greenhouse that actually this is our sort of learning year,
mm-hmm.
and we've learned a huge amount.
Okay.
Well,
did you make mistakes?
Yeah, we've made
mistakes.
We tried to grow sweet potatoes and
didn't happen?
No.
Now, why not?
Because we couldn't keep the soil warm enough and in the right temperature and right moisture content. And so, one of the biggest successes is our...
For some reason, Cindy didn't seem to want to dwell on the sweet potatoes, but instead went on fairly quickly to tell me about the great success of their spinach crop, which had yielded 4 or 5 cuttings. Then we got down to brass tacks, or bare bones, or the heart of the matter. Choose your metaphor. We're talking tomatoes.
Yeah.
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 And so we grew 3 or 4 kinds of tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
We grew 2 kinds of...
And how did those go? I mean, those are sometimes taken as the measure of the gardener. And I have to say that by that measure, I'm not a gardener at all this
yeah.
year. But
yeah.
How were yours?
We had a huge crop of tomatoes. Huge.
All right.
And we had salad tomatoes. We had little...
cherry tomatoes.
Cherry
or grape
tomatoes. Heirloom tomatoes.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, we did really well.
Now, heirlooms often have not been bred to resist diseases. So did you have any problems with tomato diseases?
We did not.
You did not.
No. We had problems with diseases in our squash and our cucumbers and our beans. They all got...
Beans?
They got this sort of white dust.
Mildew?
Yeah, it isn't mildew, but there's a special name for it. I forget what it is.
And was this in or out of the greenhouse or both?
No, I'm talking about in the greenhouse.
This is all in the greenhouse.
Yeah. So we grew beans, we grew chard, we grew all kinds of herbs, we grew spinach, greens, we grew romaine lettuce, several kinds of romaine lettuce.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, patty pan squash, zucchini, sweet peppers. What else? I think that about covers
That's
it.
That's a fair amount.
Oh, we grew broccoli and cabbage.
Right.
Yeah, and onions. Yeah.
Nice. And all of this was sold at the farmer's market?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Who is we? Who is doing this work?
Volunteers.
Okay, you mentioned education. What are you doing with that?
We started working with the schools in seeing if we could get two or three teachers involved and interested in the idea of doing a fresh food curriculum within the classroom.
A fresh food curriculum?
Yeah.
Now, what does that involve?
Well, it involves teaching children about where their food comes from, basically.
Okay.
Having them grow it.
Isn't it astonishing that you have to teach people, kids in Montana, this?
Yeah. A lot of the kids that we worked with are, you know, in the very beginning, they had never, ever touched soil.
And this is Ennis. And how large is Ennis?
It's about 1,000 people.
It's 1,000 people?
It's very rural.
It's very rural, but they know nothing about where their food comes from.
Right.
Wow.
So we started with an outside garden at the community garden in Jeffers, and we got the third graders planting pumpkins, potatoes, corn, and squash. Or squash, pumpkins are squash. So squash, the three sisters. And so
We so got squash, corn, and beans.
Beans,
right.
And we got the third graders to, the third grade classes planted, they dug up the soil, planted these crops, and we grew them through the summer. And then as fourth graders, they came in the fall and harvested them.
Nice.
Yeah, and that was our first introduction to the school.
Who took care of that garden during the summer?
Well, some of the kids and their parents agreed to do that.
Great, great.
So that worked out really well.
And did they get a good harvest?
They did. Yeah,
it was amazing.
They were very excited. And so in tandem with that, we introduced an actual curriculum based on studying production of food through mathematics, through reading, through literature, through all the disciplines
all the different subjects.
And then beyond that, we introduced compost making in the classrooms with red wiggle worms.
And so you were doing vermiculture right there in the classrooms.
Right. And so what happened is the kids would gather leftover food from the lunch program and feed the worms the leftover food.
Right.
And so thus making compost. So
where did that compost go? Into their garden?
It went into our greenhouse.
Into the greenhouse. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Nice.
And eventually, in a school just had a remodel and an addition, and they are going to have a greenhouse at the school, and they're also going to have an outdoor garden.
Great.
And so our curriculum will, you know, go totally into that.
Right. And it'll be right there for them instead of them having to travel to. How far away is Jeffers?
Jeffers is a mile away.
Okay, so not far, but still they'll be able to walk outside to it instead of getting on a bus.
Right, and that'll be an education garden.
Right. So are you working only with young kids in this area of education?
Yeah, we're only working in K through 5 right now, because the high school kids we feel are somewhat of a lost cause already. So we're starting young.
Right.
And The superintendent is totally behind us. Mm-hmm. He's been so cooperative, and it's just been amazing.
Do you do anything with adult education?
We do. We are doing adult ed classes in beginning gardening, in the history of gardening.
In the history of gardening?
Yeah, huh. Through like the Victory Garden idea from World War II and what that's all about. We're doing a whole class on that. We're doing... And so the people that go to the beginning gardening class in the spring, they actually come out and work in our garden as part of their class.
That's sort of like the Master Gardener curriculum where you take spend a certain amount of time in class and then you're expected to contribute.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
So then beyond all of that, we now... in our greenhouse, we are now producing food for the school lunch program.
Mm-hmm.
So we sell carrots, spinach, lettuce, broccoli, and tomatoes directly to the school lunch program.
Uh-huh.
And so we make a little bit of money on that.
And the kids get to grow, to eat stuff that they've contributed to.
Right. The spinach that we provide the schools lasts 2 weeks longer than what they buy from Sysco.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes the lunchroom people they're delighted by that.
I bet.
Because then, it lowers their bill, plus it's fresh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've noticed this.
Yeah.
The idea, there's a myth out there that organic things don't last as long.
Yeah.
And it depends partly on how far they've been trucked.
Right.
Or largely, I'd say, on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go look at this place.
Yeah.
We are at the greenhouses. Two quite remarkable structures, round, just as you would expect, sort of hemispheres, and some 70 feet long each.
This one isn't.
Okay.
This one is 40 feet, I think.
Okay.
This is our teaching green.
All right, and it's divided in the middle. Interesting.
That's a classroom back there.
Okay.
This is our processing area.
All right.
We process vegetables.
And I have to say, I'm a little surprised because they don't have soil, they've got gravel.
Yeah, and that's why this is where we're going to start our seedlings back here for the greenhouse, for the production greenhouse.
All right.
And this is our processing area where we process our produce from the greenhouse before we take it to the market.
So what we're looking at here is a number of tables which are actually slats rather than being boards.
So we process our vegetables here. We sort them, clean them, bag them. We weigh everything for the market.
Right.
And then we take it all every week over to the cooler at the school, put it, display.
So the school is helping you out that way.
Oh, yeah.
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 Now, another thing I notice is that, overhead there are the aluminum hoops, but there is also some sort of dark netting underneath
those. And that's called
those.
Shade cloth.
Okay.
At one day we were in here and it was 120 degrees.
So that's too hot.
Yeah, yeah. And this particular greenhouse doesn't have a fan system. So.
Does it have vents?
No.
I didn't think so. I don't see any.
We didn't build it that way, and so we have to compensate. We have to have shade cloth and, keep the doors open.
Does it help, the shade cloth?
Yeah.
Okay.
It helps a lot.
Okay.
But not enough.
I see. Now, there's a little motor sound, and over against one wall, there's a small, really remarkably small little black thing attached to one of the struts, and that is blowing the air between the two layers of the walls.
Polyurethane.
Right.
Yeah.
So we've just walked into this second greenhouse, which feels enormous and is open all the way down and has three raised beds on the right of this wide central path, three on the left, and then a wide path across the center. And stuff's still growing here. Masses of greens, just beautiful charred, four or five different kinds of lettuce.
Carrots.
Some beets, kale, carrots, lots of carrots. It's extraordinary. And the heads of lettuce are enormous. They're really at least as big as you'd get in the supermarket, those red leaf lettuces mm-hmm. in particular. And you've got romaine, and you've got gorgeous spinach, which
yeah.
you've given me a taste of, and it's wonderful. And a variety of others over here, very deep red oaks, and some that have been cut back, and you can see the new growth coming. Now, some people have success with this, and some do not. Are you cutting it at the stem, or are you cutting individual leaves off the bottom?
We just cut it like this.
You just chop it off. And
no particular. You know, we just cut it.
And it works. And this is a red oak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
green
this,
and
all of this lettuce we either sell in our market or sell to the schools.
And how many crops do you manage to get off these?
4 to 5.
Wow.
And the same with the spinach.
That's really, and the spinach is so pretty.
We hand pick each leaf. So,
right.
You know, that's pretty labor intensive.
Right. So, and there's a bunch of thick stalks sticking out, and you can tell those have been yeah. trimmed, but the vegetation is 3 or 4 inches high, and it's young and lush and just beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you worry a whole lot about spacing out the plants? They look quite close together. It looks like a very intense planting.
Yeah, this is intensive growing,
right.
And we don't worry about that.
Right.
I mean, you can tell that the romaine is spaced somewhat.
But something like 6 inches apart, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Quite close. And these carrots are poking themselves up out of the ground. They're so eager, and they are, again, quite close together.
Yeah.
Much closer than...
We harvest them in a manner in which they're being thinned. So.
Right. That's what I always do, too. So you would take the biggest ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
I do that with lettuce, too.
Yeah.
I overplant, and then I pick out the biggest ones.
Yeah.
And I just keep doing that, and so I always have young, fresh lettuce, and the last few are let grow
the heads. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's nice.
So we have beets over there, chard, 3 kinds of chard.
At least.
We just have taken out all the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the broccoli, the squash.
What did you do with all those plants?
Some of them, because they had the
mildew-like disease.
Yeah,
right.
We took those to the dump. The others went into our compost heap.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And those were just growing freestanding here, or did you have climbers?
We had trellises that go up 12 feet
for the
tomatoes. So these were like walls of tomatoes that were here. Yeah. And walls of cucumbers.
And did you have a single row down the center of these?
No, two rows.
Two rows. Now, this is a planter that's 3 feet wide at most.
Yeah.
And you have two rows in it.
Uh-huh.
You really are doing intensive planting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are.
Right.
Yeah.
And these beds are, you have two 20-foot long beds end to end, then a center aisle and another pair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So there's actually plenty of room to move, but there's a lot of space for the plants.
Yeah. So
I see a worm bed.
Oh, the worm bed. That's the kids' worm bed. They grew worms, as I said earlier, in the classroom.
Right.
And then using composting, and brought the worms over here and put them in that bed, and we feed the worms our leavings from some vegetables.
You don't harvest the worm compost.
No.
So what good does it do if they're one end of one bed?
The worms are migrating throughout the greenhouse, basically. Any bed that you dig in here, you'll find worms.
And that was not true originally.
Correct.
And that would be explained as we step outside and look at the soil, because it is extremely inhospitable-looking soil.
Yeah.
It's very... Oh, it's a completely different color. It's sort of a pale gray, grayish-brown, and very stony. Is it really like that if you dig into it?
Yeah, you can't dig into it.
Imagine that. Soil that you can't dig into.
Our walk took us past the compost heap, which was a large L-shaped arrangement of straw bales facing west to capture the afternoon sun, and past the shed in which was stored soil amendments, seeds, potting soil, a few tools, but most importantly, the pipes that would eventually be receiving the hot water, which would be used to heat the underground pipes under the greenhouse itself.
Okay, this is all the mechanism for the tubing and all the plumbing that is associated with the tubes.
This is a bunch of big black plastic pipes with gauges at the top sticking up out of a hole in the floor of this shed. Ta-da! As for how the shed got there,
what we did is we brought the shed from the ice skate rink and lifted it up with a crane, because these were all here.
Oh,
we
the pipes were here.
We lifted it up and lowered it on that.
Oh, my gosh! East of the shed and greenhouse, the land dropped away towards an oddly squared-off pond a couple of dozen yards across. Okay, maybe it was 50 yards across. I wasn't sure then, and I don't remember now, but I do remember the scenery beyond it, because beyond it lay the valley, flat until it reached a line of taller brush, which was reddish and yellowish with its autumn colors. That marked the Madison River, one of the three rivers that join at the town Three Forks, about 30 or 40 miles north of Venice, to form the Missouri. Beyond the river, the land rose again into some of those stunning Rocky Mountain peaks, already snow-dusted. These were the Madison Range. When we left the shed, we walked east and south towards the pond, which Cindy told me was a holding pond for the hot springs to allow the water to cool before working its way towards the river. Hot water, of course, would be bad for the fish, and in Montana, fish rule. We had a laugh over that, but it's true. I mean, remember, a river runs through it. This is fisherman's paradise, and no one's going to mess that up, not for nothing. Apparently, the birds, unlike the fish, don't mind the warm water or even the supposedly toxic chemicals in it, because according to Cindy, that pond was usually covered with geese and other waterfowl. I'm afraid you'll have to take my word for it, though, instead of hers, because the wind was doing a number on my microphone, and this section of the recording is nearly inaudible. When I asked Cindy if the pond was artificial, something about that shape seemed off, she said yes. Then I asked where the water came from. Oh, from the hot springs, she said. And despite the terrible conditions and the wind, I think you can hear the shock in my voice as I responded. All of this?
Yeah.
Okay, I had assumed that this was cold water that came in either from a spring or from the river, and then the hot spring drained into it.
But no, this is created by the hot spring.
This is a lot of water.
Yeah, well, a lot of water comes out of the hot spring.
This I finally saw for myself, because we were now standing within a yard or two of the edge of the pond. We had passed a large, rusting metal tank, like a water tank, a couple stories high, and a couple of smaller steel structures. None of those was relevant, Cindy assured me. What we were really supposed to be looking at was down low to the ground, and not all that dramatic looking.
Okay, here's the water coming out of the earth right there.
Okay, and there's a barrel, and there's a pipe, and there's a bunch of water flowing. Most of it's going straight into the holding pond.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of steam showing that it's hot.
Right.
Okay?
Okay. So this is Madison Farm to Forks addition to this pipe that's bringing the hot water out.
And this is a big pipe, what, 6 or 8 inches or
yeah,
more in diameter.
So the hot water eventually will be diverted to this big one right here.
Yet another pipe.
And it'll go down into this tank, which was...
Which doesn't look like much. It's just some boards.
And a steel, it's steel, actually.
Steel sides.
And this was welded together and created by the adult education welding class at the high school.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And this is where the heat exchangers are.
Right.
The steel tank welded by the adult education welding class, in case you missed that last bit, was set into the earth, and the boards over the top were at ground level. They were, as Cindy pointed out, really, really heavy plywood, and it took our combined strength to shift one of them out of the way. When we did, this is what we saw. So we've lifted one of these boards. Underneath, there's a bunch of rather grungy-looking water. Oh, and there are two big pieces of metal sitting in that water. Yep. Here, at last, were the rumored heat exchangers, whose operation, I promise you, will be explained in just a couple of minutes.
The water that's coming out of the earth is 190 degrees.
That's warm.
Yeah. And everywhere around here, probably within a mile radius surrounding this hot spring, the owner of the hot springs, he owns an RV park up here, and he has made several attempts to find cold water, and he's found it almost impossible to find cold water. So they have, some of the RV people have hot water in their toilets.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. This hot springs is the largest hot springs in Montana.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. You wouldn't know it, because it's not developed or anything.
Are you going to have a backup system, propane system, for emergency cold spells?
No.
No?
No.
Well, that seemed clear. The answer was no. No backup system. These people were self-reliant. However, when I caught Cindy off guard with a question about whether there had been any outside consultants involved in the project, she did confess.
We did a limited amount. For the most part, the chairman of our council, who is a scientist himself, figured out how to go about doing this.
What kind of scientist?
He is a neurophysicist.
That's impressive, but it doesn't sound strictly applicable.
Yeah.
Then Cindy pulled the rug out from under any idea, however fanciful, that her group didn't want to share credit with others, for she volunteered the statement that the whole project depends on volunteers. 2,500 hours worth of volunteer labor, she said. And this is labor freely given, as I found out when I asked. Do your volunteers get to take some lettuce home?
No, not really. At this point, we ask volunteers just for their time.
Right. And they give it. But it is innovative.
Yeah.
And interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, this has really been great to see this. And I want to thank you, Cindy, for showing me around and explaining it to me.
You're
and
welcome.
All the rest. I wonder how many other places would be able to do something similar. At least...
Yeah, hey, that's a good question.
Here in the Northwest. Because it's not just Montana that has hot springs.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll catch on and you'll be the trailblazers.
Yeah, right. Yep. It's a pretty big vision and inspired.
Yes, it is. It is. The landscape must have.
Yeah.
It's inspiring. Yeah. Well, thanks again.
You're welcome.
All right. We will check back and see how this first winter growing season goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Definitely.
Good. We'll be in touch then.
Okay.
Bye. That was Cindy Owings, secretary and founding member of Madison Farm to Fork, based in Madison County here in Montana. They're on the verge of getting their geothermally green heated greenhouse up and running. A couple of weeks after speaking with Cindy, I talked with the scientist whom she mentioned near the end of our interview, Jim Patrick. He's president of the nonprofit company Madison Farm to Fork. And as I told him, I was hoping he would be able to answer some of the more technical questions, especially how did the heat exchange plates work? Jim explained that water from the hot spring would be constantly circulating into and then back out of the tank that I had seen, the one that Cindy and I had barely managed to pull a cover off of. And then Jim described what was going on in the two huge plates that I had seen inside that tank. Here's what he said.
Inside the tank, there are two plates that are 12 feet long by 4 feet high by 5/8 of an inch thick.
Only 5/8 of an inch.
Right.
Okay.
And each plate has an inlet and an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Two plates are connected in series, so water flows in one plate, out of that plate into the second plate,
okay.
and out of that plate into a pipe.
Mm-hmm.
That pipe, the inlet pipe and the outlet pipe, is buried and runs underground up to the shed near the greenhouse where there is a pump.
You're talking now about the inlet and outlet pipes for the plates.
Yes.
Okay.
So one is a supply and one's a return,
mm-hmm.
and they run up to the shed, and
right.
water will circulate through those pipes and through the plates, and in the process, they will be heated by the water that's in the tank.
So these plates, which are only 5/8 of an inch thick, allow water to flow through them.
Yes. Each one holds 9 gallons of water.
That's only 9 gallons. That's amazing yep. that's enough to do the job.
Yes.
I think that's fascinating. So essentially, you pump the water through the plates, and because the plates are immersed in the very hot water, the water inside the plates gets heated.
That's right. And that's why they're called heat exchangers.
Right, right. Fairly simple.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That clarifies an enormous amount.
I'm glad it worked for you.
So how much energy has to be spent pumping this water?
I don't have that exact number. It's because we haven't actually purchased the pump yet, so we don't know the wattage on it, but it's not very much. They're not very big pumps.
Really? Which, again, is, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
But wonderful.
Well, it's a closed circuit, so mm-hmm. it's the water goes in one side and out the other side.
And then goes back around?
Yes.
Right.
Back down to the heat exchanger plates.
Right. And just continues to circulate.
Yes.
Right. So how many pipes have you got underneath the greenhouse and that outside area?
And in the greenhouse, there are, I believe, 12 beds.
That sounds right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 12 beds. And each bed has 300 feet of PEX tubing in it.
Of what tubing?
PEX. It's a half-inch tubing. It's the same kind of tubing that goes under people's floors when they have radiant floor heating.
Oh, okay.
In the outdoor greenhouse, there's the same amount of tubing underground.
Right. Will you stop heating the outdoor area after you harvest there?
Yes. Yes. After the season's done, we'll stop heating that, but we'll heat it earlier in the spring so we can perhaps get a earlier start on growing.
I bet you can.
I think so. I think it will make a pretty good difference.
Right. Yeah. Now, these pipes are laid 4 feet down. Is that right?
No, they're 21 inches.
Oh, excuse me. Okay. And then in the greenhouse, the beds are built up another foot above that or so?
Another foot on top of that.
Right. Okay, I've got a question, actually.
Right.
You're heating only the ground.
Yep.
Is that sufficient to keep the plants alive?
Yes. It will heat the air some, but not as much as if you had, for example, forced air heating.
Right.
Because it will be radiant heating from the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as a gardener, you know that it's the temperature of the ground that determines whether things ripen or not.
Right, or whether they sprout to begin with.
Or whether they sprout.
Right.
And I think it's an interesting experiment, and we hope it works.
Yes, I do too.
And I should say that our technology was developed with a great deal of help from Tyler America, who works with Harvard.
Okay.
And they are a geothermal heat exchange specialist.
Oh, how convenient. That's wonderful. Now, I asked Cindy who had helped design your system, and she said that there was a neurophysicist involved?
That would be me.
And is that right?
Well, neuroscientist.
Neuroscientist?
Yes.
So you're a little outside your primary field when you're doing this.
Oh, yeah, quite a ways.
Yeah.
But science is science, so...
Right. Right. Okay. Cindy also said you were something like $10,000 away from being able to put all the pieces together. Is part of that buying the pump?
Part of it is building the manifolds and buying the pumps. And part of the stuff that's going to go in the greenhouse and go underground has to be propylene glycol so it won't freeze.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a relatively expensive proposition as well.
I see. What are the manifolds?
A manifold is, for example, in the greenhouse, we have the hot water comes in and it goes into a device that can independently direct it towards any one of the 12 beds.
I see.
And it has valves on it.
Okay.
And those valves determine which beds get heated at which time.
Right. Okay.
Well, the ones in the greenhouse are put in, but there's an analogous system that's going to be in the shed, which will decide whether the water goes into the outdoor garden or into the greenhouse.
Right. And that needs to be established still?
That needs to be built and installed.
Got it. Okay.
That should all be in place by the end of this month.
That is very exciting. I am really looking forward to coming and seeing it in full production.
Yes. Well, I can't wait to see green in there in January. So.
Yeah. Yeah. When I saw it a couple of weeks ago, it was still very green. But if you can keep that in January, you've really got something.
Exciting. We're looking forward to it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jim.
All righty. Good luck with this.
All right. Thanks.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That was Jim Patrick of Madison Farm to Fork. Be sure to check out their website, madisonfarmtofork.com. Now for the weekly gardening tip. It's November, and the gardening season is pretty much wound down across virtually all of North America. And in case you're tempted to try to grow a few edible things inside, it's doubtful that carrots is on your list. And I am here to encourage you to give that a try. I've run into exactly one site that says, yes, carrots can easily be grown in containers. And even it says that those containers need to be at least a foot deep. And it says nothing about having any of those containers inside, whatever their depth. Well, I was growing them in my basement last year in 6-inch deep, cheap plastic containers from the hardware store. Nothing fancy, believe me, except for the fact that I did put very good soil into them. Obviously, in such a shallow container, only very small carrots will grow, so I recommend little fingers. And even those, if left too long, will hit the bottom of the container and take off sideways. If you want to see a picture of one that has done this, a carrot with a sharp right angle in it, you can check out my blog, thematicgardener.com. At any rate, the important thing here is that the seeds need to be kept damp while they're germinating. It takes a long time for carrots to start, 14 to 21 days. And then there needs to be adequate light. But that adequate light can be provided by a quite cheap fluorescent fixture as long as it's got a full-spectrum bulb in it. There's something truly delectable about chopping up a couple of little sweet, fresh carrots into a salad in February. So give it a try. Let me know how it works on the blog. Good gardening. See you next week.